I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and archived on TVTimeMachine.com.
On a hot August night in 1922, the Chicago police arrested a drunken young man for brandishing a pistol after a traffic accident. He didn't seem worried. "I'll fix this thing so easy you won't know how it's done," he said. He was right. The charges against him were quickly dropped. The newspapers spelled his name wrong, but he had produced his first headline. Alphonse Capone was just 23 years old and was suspected of murdering at least two men in his native Brooklyn before coming to Chicago. A violent confrontation with the knife-wielding brother of a young woman he had insulted had left him with three cuts on his cheek that would earn him the nickname Scarface.
We're back again with Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns, whose brand new documentary Prohibition begins October 2nd on PBS, right here on the TV Time Machine. Ken, tell us about Scarface, Al Capone.
Well, you know, we were in some ways reluctant to go back into that because he's been so mythologized, but we thought we could add a new dimension to the story of Al Capone, that it was not just the ruthless gangster ordering the St. Valentine's Day murder or the ultra witch, but a new phenomenon in America, which is a kind of bold-faced superstar on the level of Babe Ruth, who, you know, glided through the city in a limousine with kids chasing after him, who had a phalanx of bodyguards not unlike the superstars of today, that whenever they appeared at this party or at the ballpark or the racetrack would be drawn to like moths to a flame. He was an irresistible kind of celebrity, and what we wanted to show was both the simplicity of his criminality but the complexity in relationship to our own ambivalence to the law. Bootleggers somehow weren't as bad as the petty thieves they used to be. The murderer back in Brooklyn, you know, he was now a guy providing, you know, hospitality to people, and what could be so bad about that? And I think we tried to expose, as our film develops, the inherent hypocrisy in the prohibition laws, and of course the unintended consequence. He might be the most obvious of the unintended consequences. If we had not passed prohibition, we would not have organized crime in our country, full stop. Without prohibition, female alcoholism would not be as big a social problem as it is today, because women never went into the saloons. Unless you were a prostitute, alcohol was not in your life except if you were very rich, where you might have wine at dinner, or if you were a housewife that might, you know, just to make it through the day, like mother's little helpers would swig on Lydia Pinkham's vegetable compound, right, which had a lot of alcohol in it, and Frances Willard of the Women's Christian Temperance Union did put together an inebriate's asylum for women. But for the most part, you know, it was a law in which almost everyone ignored and created a whole world of criminality. And you could argue that Al Capone was the greatest beneficiary of the hypocrisy inbred in this law. I mean, when you pass a law that says don't murder somebody, you're basically passing a law that codifies which 99% of the population believes. But when you pass a law saying you can't drink anymore, and many cultures and many religious dimensions of the culture have wine as part, say, of a sacrament, you're saying something else. And as one of the historians in our film, more often than not, people found that it was prohibition for somebody else. That is to say, it was a way for small-town America to try to control those new immigrants that were coming from Central and Southern Europe. It was a way to control African-Americans who now could not only vote, but my goodness, with a bottle in one hand and a ballot in the other, what trouble they could cause. So it was always, you know, we don't need it, therefore no one else should need it. And that was a really American, but also, as we see in retrospect, un-American thing to do, to be.
Yes, the thing that really struck me about your documentary was the issue of hypocrisy at the time, the moral ambiguity that prohibition manifested, and the fact that it put people into positions where they became criminals, where heretofore they weren't.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And when you criminalize that, then you're offering many opportunities for those people who are criminals to make a lot of money. And you have to understand that the hypocrisy begins at the top. You have the first president under whom prohibition went into effect was Warren G. Harding, who was ostensibly and publicly against it, but each week had what was called his whiskey cabinet, a poker game that was supplied, you know, liquefied, if you will, by a local bootlegger who came to the White House. The Justice Department was filled with people selling sort of protections and certificates that would permit people access to closed and shuttered bonded government warehouses to distribute this stuff. The prohibition agents were corrupted. They stole the liquor. They resold it. People got paid off. You couldn't trust the judges. You couldn't trust the officers in the police force. You couldn't trust the local guys. And the whole system, as the writer Pete Hamill so eloquently in our film said, the whole system gets corrupted this way. And finally, what you see in its downfall, besides the Depression coming in and sort of making illogical the lack of tax revenues that could be, you know, brought in by alcohol, but the number of jobs. It used to be the fifth largest industry in America when you count all the teamsters and barrel makers and waiters and bartenders. This is a huge group of people put out of work. It's just an amazing story. We got a tiger by the tail and just rode it as long as we could.
Ken, we, all of us, have learned a great deal from your films. During the course of your work, what have you learned?
Well, you know, it's myriad things. They come in specifics, say in Prohibition, that somehow the country that had just banned the sale of alcohol became the largest importer of cocktail shakers. The humor of the Civil War that we learned. All of these things are fascinating little pieces of the puzzle, the excruciating ironies of the past. But I think it's less what you learn, it's how you ask the question. I've said that each film that I've made asks one deceptively simple question: who are we? Who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And what does an investigation of the past tell us about not only where we've been, that is to say, that history that we're doing, but where we are and where we're going? You'll never answer that question, but you can deepen it. And what you deepen is an appreciation of those, you know, paradoxes that we are both purient and Puritan, that we are generous and greedy, that we are both independent and collective in spirit, and many, many other paradoxes that we are drawn to inexorably as we begin to go beneath just the superficial views, the Madison Avenue, sanitized views of history we're usually presented with. And at the end, you come down to the deepest sorts of understanding about human freedom and what's required. And it's not easy. It doesn't make a simplistic political slogan, because more often than not, you find in American history lessons that apply today. And more often than not, those lessons, the answer is neither and both. That is to say, both things are required. You need less government and more government. You need more individualism and more collectivism. That you need to be both, almost religiously proper and at the same time be liberated in your thought and your actions. All of these things are seeming contradictions, but if you embrace them, you begin to see them as just parts of a whole. And, you know, we suffer today, the historian Arthur Schlesinger said, from too much pluribus and not enough unum, referring to the Latin motto, e pluribus unum, out of many one. And we do feel that. We bemoan the lack of civil discourse in our politics. We bemoan the lack of shared sacrifice. Why, 10 years ago after 9/11, weren't we asked to do a laundry list of things we would have immediately agreed to in order to come together and might not be discussing budgets to this day, might not be discussing dependence on foreign oil, might not be discussing a cheapened political discourse. Americans are an incredibly resilient thing, people, and I think that in the end, the thing that I've learned the most about is not to succumb to the idea of American exceptionalism, but to go and find out that it is there, despite the people, the charlatans, the carnival barkers, which would try to sell you the snake oil of exceptionalism every day without asking the tougher questions, not only of the country, but of themselves. That in the end, you know, when things got tough in the Depression, when things got tough in World War II, when things have gotten tough at times, there is no limit to what these people, our people, your and my people, can do.
Ken, is there a website where people can learn more about Prohibition?
Well, if they go to pbs.org/prohibition, they will have a website. If it isn't up right now, it will certainly be up within a few weeks of the broadcast on October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and then will be quite extensive after the broadcast. The DVDs will be available the day of the broadcast, and of course, we then enjoy a tremendous afterlife in schools as we use this deservedly much maligned medium of television and bemoan its superficiality and find that, in fact, in a few cases, it isn't so superficial, that it does have some value in our educational system. And to my great pleasure, these films live on well beyond their broadcast date.
You mentioned the DVD. Are there any bonus materials on the DVD?
There's tons.
Right.
You know, deleted scenes, commentary, making of, backstories that we like to tell. I'm not a big fan of director's cut because I have the great privilege of working in public broadcasting, and the film I put out is my cut. I wouldn't have it any other way, and I would leave PBS if I didn't have that, but I don't need to because they've given me that great privilege and honor that extended that trust. And so I think what the extras are will be a fascinating sort of behind-the-stage look at our process and how these films are made, the decisions, the discoveries, the people that influenced our ability to tell the story.
Do you have any new projects in the works?
We're working on 7 other projects.
Oh, okay. Just a couple.
Promoting Prohibition. We just finished editing, and we'll have out next year, History of the Dust Bowl. We're editing a film on the Central Park jogger case. We have a mammoth series halfway through editing on Theodore Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. Believe it or not, nobody's put them all together in a major television series. We're shooting a film on a biography of Jackie Robinson. We are waist-deep in the Big Muddy trying to come to terms with a history of Vietnam that would go along with our Civil War and Second World War series that will be out in 2016, and we are deep into research on a film on country music and beginning to think about another film biography of the writer Ernest Hemingway. That takes us to the end of this decade.
Wow. Ken, as you look back on your remarkable body of work and the productions you mentioned yet to come, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that in a strange way, particularly at a time when we feel so ill at ease with our economy, with our institutions, with our future, that I would suggest that history holds out a great deal of hope. It can give you some real, just practical information about how you solve problems, what the nature of leadership is all about, how you transcend petty differences. We are a nation, of course, built on compromise, and we have in the Civil War the glaring example when compromise broke down and when people wouldn't budge an inch, and it ought to be an extraordinary cautionary tale to us. But I think in the end we find you know, in the inspirational leadership of Abraham Lincoln and others, the sense of this appeal to the better angels of our nature, as Lincoln did in his first inaugural, that's all I'm interested in. I want to know what those better angels are. And I guess every film is an attempt to find those better angels.
Ken, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you aboard the TV Time Machine. Feel free to join us again in the future or in the past.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken. This is Jim Benson. Join us again next time as our magical transport takes us on yet another journey exploring television's past, present, and future. You'll find your next adventure right here on the TV Time Machine.